Well, to be honest, I'm just looking forward to meeting you. You know, don't want to podcast at all. I'll refuse to speak. I just say to Dean, oh, Dean, thanks for bringing Sparky up. I just wanted to say hello.
Raised on songs and stories,
heroes of renown, the passing tales and glories. That once was Dublin town, the hallowed halls and houses, the haunting children's rhymes, that once was part of Dublin in the rare old times. Ring a rosy, as the light declines, I remember Dublin City in the rare old times.
Yo, fuck off, will you? Fresh, yeah?
Shut the fuck up!
Episode 22, the Fresh Batch Podcast. Myself and Dean have driven a couple of hours down to my good friend, John Rooney.
How are you, Ray? How are things?
Myself and John are friends through recovery. We met online. Now, it wasn't on any of the apps or anything like that now. It was
Tinder,
during
was it?
COVID, a lot of the meetings went online, you know, and I was lucky enough to meet John and loads of other different people from different parts of the world. But myself and John struck up a good friendship over the phone, over the WhatsApp, and over the years we've been good friends. But John, you got a bit of bad news about your health.
They said I'd approximately a year to live. I had end stage heart disease and they were trying to fit a few stents and whatever, you know, like I had had the quadruple bypass. I had 7 or 8 stents fitted and this was the outcome anyway, that there was nothing they could do. They said they'd keep me comfortable and monitor my drugs, and it's well past a year.
Yeah, the last time I was here was September last year and you were bedridden then. But you're not bedridden today.
I'm not for a while anyway. I'm in good form.
You're in great form.
I got a great lift when I heard yourself and Dean were coming down to do the podcast, and I thought, geez, this is great. I was even thinking about it last night. It's just now small little things that I've left that can give me a...
Because I even noticed there when we were getting ready, you made a little video for the family in... on the WhatsApp group, you know?
Yeah.
And I always said to you that you had a great face for radio, but you've a great voice for radio. And I was always saying to you, in recovery, we have different things that we read out and stuff like that. And I was saying to John, you should record them because you've a great voice and they could go on YouTube, you know, for people that have difficulty reading or difficulty kind of retaining stuff, like, you know what I mean? And you've a great voice for that kind of stuff.
You have a soft old voice.
John. He has a soft voice, isn't he?
It's half Dublin, half Mayo, isn't it, Dean? I was born and reared in Coolock, but I'm 40 years here now in Mayo.
Are you 40 years?
Oh, God, I am, Ray, yeah.
How this kind of came about was somebody told me, sent me a clip of Joe Duffy, and I wouldn't normally listen to Joe Duffy now, and because I'd be in work at that time.
He doesn't listen to you either.
But they said that there was this guy talks about recovery, and I said, I better listen to this. Next thing, the bell, John, was on the Joe Duffy, and it was a great interview. He really looked after you, you know. I thought, like, I'm always giving out about RTE, but Duffy was great that day. I thought he was great.
He was spot on. He's a good broadcaster. I mean, I went on to talk about the fact that the water in our village here in Mulrani was poisoned, and it was a do not drink kind of notice they put out. But I wasn't told, and of course, I'm not that healthy, and I'd taken litres of water with dozens of tablets that morning. So I got on to Joe, but what the researchers do is they ask for your Facebook page, your life story. Could you send them you know, the top of a bank statement, but it's amazing.
Just in case you come out as a fucking
exactly
a threat to their organization.
Exactly. And could we have your firstborn? So I says, fine, that's all right. I did all that. So Joe knew the life story and I wanted to talk about the water. And we duly spoke about poison water in the west of Ireland. And he said, water.
Joe, terrible.
Yeah. And you're in bed, dying in the bed. So that was it.
But you know what the thing was, and right?
Is it just yourself dying there?
But I thought what was miraculous was, I think the water wasn't, I think it was, it was Lord's water or something you got, because the last time I was here, you were in bed. I came in here today and you're walking. So maybe you should try and get in touch with Irish Water and find out exactly what kind of poison water it was, because it might be good.
Whatever it was, they should bottle it. I think they already have, right?
Well, you were drinking litres of it anyway.
But come here, you gave him gold dust. You gave a radio presenter gold dust. And even on the voice messages that you left Sparky, slagging me and him on the way down here, which we're going to use in the podcast as little
of course we will.
To bookend.
Will you tell Dean there, Sparky, I think he might have taken a wrong turn, but mind you, that could have been feckin' decades ago.
Your turn of phrase, your softness, your accent, your humour, your acceptance of it all.
And my looks, Dean.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. You're not a miracle worker.
When I first seen John online, I said to myself, Jesus, Paul Brady's gone to bits.
When I heard you, and I'm sure I'm not the only one, I love the way we build a picture of the person in our heads. And I'm sure people are doing that now, listening to my voice, listening to your voice.
Yes.
And when people meet me, they go, "Jeez, I wasn't expecting that, because I'm big and loud in my voice. But when you meet me, I'm soft and touchy and cuddly." Where does that voice come from? Where does that acceptance come from? So bring us back to Coolock.
Coolock, my goodness. Well, I loved it. Now, it was a strange upbringing, because part of it, of course, was we all had to go to school, and I went to Scullwira and the Irish Christian Brothers, and it was horrific. You know, they were very sad people. I don't hold any resentments or anything toward them now, but they were, some were bad, a handful were good, and some were sadistic animals, you know. So that was tough.
It was a healthy mix of madness.
Because, and a thing I thought was particularly cruel, we'd say, just to give you one example, on a Friday evening, they'd give you a 2-page Irish essay to learn by heart. And they'd start off on Monday morning in the class. There were 64 of us in the class. And the brother would stand up in front and he'd get everybody to start reciting. He'd go around the class and he'd keep that up until every single child in that class had missed one phrase or one sentence. And then a team of the brothers and lay teachers would come in and they'd leather us. So that's how one started each Monday morning. And then there's things about my childhood that were magical. Magical. It was like the world centred around Coolock. It was a village, Dean and Ray. It was an actual little village. We were in the middle of nowhere. And the slops man used to call, I remember that.
Who was the slops man?
He'd come and like, you know, your brown bin nowadays, Whatever it is. Yeah, he'd take your potato peel, the whole lot to feed his pigs. He'd give you a little toy sometimes, and that was fabulous. The coal man called, the insurance man called.
The eggs man.
The eggs man called. We had a fruit and veg man. And we had, I think it was Johnson Mooney and O'Brien. And
the bread man.
Oh, God, they'd pull out these pallets with these magical hooks, huge pallets, and they'd carry them on their shoulder up our little hill. And the smell of the batch loaf.
The batch, yeah.
The turnover, I don't know if people remember the turnover.
Turnover. And I used to work on the Johnson Mooney and O'Brien van.
Right.
So you'd go up to the yard at 5 a.m. because you had to be picked. And so if you were anyway bogeyed, he wouldn't pick you. You know, there was always this one fella, I remember, that was always left. And there was a fella worked in the yard called Dottie. and he was called Dottie because he was a bit dotty in the head. And, you know, there'd be always accidents in the bread truck with Dottie because he'd let the handbrake off and roll down a hill or something like that. But this young fella always ended up going with Dottie, you know. The one thing that we used to love doing was peeling off the side of the batch, you know, when nobody was looking. Gorgeous. You know, the fresh batch. And I'm not the one that was wrapped and sliced, the other one. And you'd peel off the side of that or off the turnovers.
Sparky's in recovery from the fresh batch.
I'm in recovery from the cream cakes that they used to have. They used to, if there was fresh cream cakes left over at the end of the day. Now, I'm not like, there was donuts, but there was another one that was a long one that had cream in the middle.
That's right, yeah.
Eclair, was it?
No, it was like an eclair.
Same shape as an eclair.
Same shape as an eclair. So it was like a donut, like a French stick, like now, you know, yeah. And it was cut in the middle and then
cream in the middle
and jam
on top of that.
There's people at home cream in their knickers.
Now listen, the texture of the pastry was kind of bumpy. Like, I don't know what way it was baked, but I can still, like, you know, one of them cakes that you open your mouth when it's 6 inches away. It's just like,
I remember opening my mouth. My ma was holding a sausage on a fork, and I was that hungry when she put it up. I opened my mouth, and this stuff came out of my mouth like I was salivating, but I jumped towards it.
Yeah, yeah.
We grew up in similar. I grew up in Ballymun, and like, as you were saying, the insurance man, the eggs man, and we were in, as Sparky's mate would say, we were in the community.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And we were steeped in the community.
Absolutely. As were we, because I remember Dana Rosemary Scallon winning the Eurovision. The song was written by a printer. My dad was in the print trade. All the family had ink in their veins. And the night that she won the Eurovision, our whole road were out, jumping up and down, clapping, applauding, just not knowing what to do with their emotions. Ireland, little tiny Ireland in 1970 or whatever, was the centre of the world. And Coolock was the centre of Ireland. It was the most magical night. I'll never forget that. There were some great community times. Do you know what, Dean? There's a little story I have in my head. Cadbury's factory was across the road from us, and Tato, and, you know, an industrial estate was built up there. And every Friday evening, the women who worked in Cadbury's, it was exclusively women. I'm sure the management were men, you know, but the women would link arms, and we would hear them before we'd see them. And the joy in the voices, they'd be walking over the hill, and just before we get a glimpse of them, we'd hear, "Una paloma blanca, I'm like a bird in the sky." And it was glorious, and it filled the air, and across they came in lines after lines after lines, going back home to eat more or wherever. And they would all stop at the, my mum would always be ready for them, and they'd stop at the gate and they'd say, "How are you, love?" And give, you know, they'd sell the broken chocolate. My mum's favourite was the fries. She was safe with that because she knew it was the only one we wouldn't rob. it was dark chocolate, Ray, you know, with this white stuff in the middle of it. And we'd get a little thing of broken chocolate. And sometimes when my mum couldn't afford it, I'd still stand at the gate, chancing my arm.
You'd probably get a free bar. Yeah.
I absolutely did. There was never one, those ladies never passed by without giving me the little. So that kind of community, you know, that kind of, that was gorgeous.
I remember when you were talking there, John, about the community days. So you'd have races. Should it be, and I wasn't a fitness fanatic, like, you know, so I wouldn't enter for anything.
Really, Ray? Joking me.
No, I wasn't. I know my, I look like I've been.
He didn't always have this stature now. You're slagging by.
So my race was the slow bicycle race because I mastered it down. I had it, and I could do the slow bicycle race. I always remember starting the race. They started the race and this young fella shot off real quick. on a try of 20.
He was slow in a different way.
He was different, yeah. But yeah, so I used to love them days and the prizes and
John,
the medals.
Stop laughing.
So the only medal I ever got was for the slow bicycle race. Then we had the road leagues. I remember they had bicycle races around the roads. Do you remember?
Yeah, I do.
And it was so simple. It was simple, but it was great stuff.
What year were you born?
I was born in 1959.
Yeah,
I was born in my grandfather's bedroom off the North Circular Road there, a little place called Goldsmith Street. So I was actually born in, he vacated the room and that's where I was born.
Because my folks told me the same. They were born in the house.
Yeah. And we had a lovely doctor. He was the doctor of everybody, you know, Dr. Carney. And he lived up where the old cattle mart was there.
Stony Batter.
And it was great. I remember, can I tell you this, lads, I have a memory of my grandfather.
No, we'll get it off you in a couple of weeks when you're not here. Yeah.
send us from the other side, John.
Yeah, I'll WhatsApp you. No, my grandfather was also called John Rooney. And I remember he was on his deathbed and he handed me, it was either a florin or a half crown.
Right.
And like even the size and the weight of it, I felt like a millionaire. And I went to the local sweet shop at the corner of Berkeley Road and you could get an ice cream. They'd open a block of ice cream and they had this little metal grill they'd put on it. So you could have a 2p, a 4p, a 6p. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think I got a 6p, like, which it was a big, big ice cream wafer. And I got a 6p and a 2p. And I ate the 2p before I got back to Granny's house. So she wouldn't, you know what I mean? And then I was licking the 6p going in.
Is that where you got the phrase, get your halfpenny bit?
I don't know.
Your truppenny bit.
Your truppenny bit. That's what it was.
Yeah. I remember there was an ice cream van. There was two ice cream vans came on the road, right? And one had cheap ice cream.
Yeah.
You know, when it was horrible. And one of them had proper creamy ice cream. You know what I mean? And I remember going out to the van and I was at the getting that thing, you know, you got a few pence and you went out and I got this big, huge ice cream. And when I turned away from the van, it fell off the top. And a dog, it was delighted with itself, like, you know. And I turned and looked at the woman and she said to me, I'll do you another one. I think it was the first time I'd ever experienced that. Somebody, you know, that there was a sense of fair play or something like that. Now, I don't really tend to look back, but I went to see David Gray the other night and he was 30 years.
God, is he 30 years
30
now?
30 years gone, yeah. And gee, it was the first album and the second album and he'd done them chronologically, right? And he had the same band with him. He had Ewan McCall's son, Neely, and he had Cleone, the drummer, who was a head case. Listening to songs and all that kind of stuff brings you back.
Oh,
I
yeah.
think, you know, brings you really back emotionally and, you know, spiritually even to a certain time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's very
evocative.
Extremely evocative. They say smell is actually one of the biggest triggers of memories, right? But I think song, you hear people thinking, they hear a song and they go right back to a disco or something they went to, or go back to Uma Paluma Blanca, you know what I mean? You hear that and it brings you back.
Uma Paluma Blanca.
I'm like a bird in the sky.
Get the guitar though.
you've music in your veins though, Ray. I mean, it is a huge part of your life.
I was blessed.
Always has been.
I was blessed because me ma's side of the family were musical. Me dad's side of the family were gamblers. My ma's brothers played accordions and all that kind of stuff. So I was into that and I joined the Artem band and I was into music and I kind of listened. But my granny had a gramophone upstairs.
Yeah.
And I used to go up and play Roy Orbison on it, you know?
Gorgeous.
Pretty Woman. And do you know what song I loved? Rock Around the Clock. You know, when you think of Bill Haley and all that, he was an old guy. Like when that was out in the 50s, he was an older guy.
Yeah.
I loved the beat and I loved all, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then what happened was when I went into first year in Plunkett, the first person I hung around with was a fella called Bernard Brady, and he was a punk. And he gave me a Sex Pistols single.
Yeah.
And that was it. I was hooked into the punk music thing. And fabulous.
North Circular, the one you were born in. Who gaff was that?
That was John and Mary Rooney's house, and my grandparents and my parents and myself lived with them for a few years. House is still there. Jeez, they're lovely houses. They're gorgeous. But and my granny lived, my mother's mother and father lived in a place called Parmesan Place opposite the bus depot in Broadstone there. And they lived in a massive big house. And I think it was divided into about four families.
They were like the old tenements.
Yeah, they were like the old tenements, yeah. But they were in good nick, you know what I mean? They had been done up by the corporation and all this. But there was only one toilet, and that was at the back, right down at the back of a long, narrow garden. You know what I mean? It used to be very scary going out there at night. And there was a man of Jewish faith. Though I wonder, am I able to say the following? Because it was meant in good. My grandmother was a fabulous woman. And this man had a great job because he had a suit and a shirt and a tie. I don't know what the man did. He most likely a pawnbroker. And she would take me by the hand and she'd say, good morning. Now, John, this is the Jew man. Say good morning. It wasn't racism.
Yeah.
It was just the nature of the, and they loved him and he loved them. It was just an accepting Dublin, a naive, gorgeous place full of potential. And then where I lived turned into, it was sad, you know, it was just concrete and a green and yeah. But anyway, they were very, very different days. My mother and father met, their first date was at the Black Church which is right halfway between Berkeley Road and Broadstone Bus Depot.
Right,
yeah, it is indeed. Before they had that date, they met on stage. My dad was a pirate king or something in Gilbert and Sullivan's operetta. I think it's the Pirates of Penzance. And my mum was one of the little maids kidnapped by him, and they started this romance. And they write in, just with a pen and a paper, if people remember, you know, and post each other letters. And my mum and dad sang in harmony. I remember that. And their harmonies were fabulous. Because every weekend in our house, there was a hoolie, there was music, you know, it was nonstop. Christmas was a month, you know what I mean? And I'd sit on the stairs and I'd listen to my uncle, and you'd swear you were listening to Frank Sinatra, you know, and I'd listen to these fabulous, it was the sing song. If there was a pub, it was the sing song. No matter where you went, it was the sing song. It's barred everywhere now, Ray.
There's a great video.
Sherry party, because I love you.
That's, my God, Uncle Gussie.
That's what I remember. Every song finished with, Shan, I love you.
There's a great video of a pub in Moore Street from the 70s or the 80s or whatever.
The women singing.
And the women are singing, but they sway. You know, they sway together, you know.
I remember being in that pub with me ma. That was the women's pub. But yeah, they had food on as well. We'd go in there and they had like a coddle on or something like that as well in that
pub. That's amazing. Because we couldn't, they invented or whatever. There was no such thing as food in any pub. And they came out especially with the pub crisps, you know. Because I remember many Sunday afternoons sitting in the car park with a pub.
That's all they're
getting. In the car, with pub crisps,
And a bottle of red lemonade.
And a bottle of lemonade,
That's all they get.
They'll be out in an hour or two.
We won't be 2 minutes now, love,
And we'll drive home gargled.
Absolutely.
I remember being in Clare at the Lookout. That's where my man died. That's the spot. That's where if we went out on a drive or not, that's where we'd end up at some stage. And I remember we were sent out the bottle of lemonade and the crisps and all that kind of stuff. But we just started wandering. We just wandered all around them hills. And
we'd have a little adventure while they're slaughtering points.
And then my dad used to bring us up golfing when he went golfing on a Saturday or a Sunday up to Deer Park. And he'd go off and play 18 holes. And me and my older sister would just ramble all up into them woods.
No.
You wouldn't do that now. Like, you wouldn't, you know. But it just was different times. We were safe. We were safe as houses.
We were dead safe too. It's amazing, yeah.
Yeah, we were dead safe. The only place we weren't safe was in institutions. Yeah. You know, in schools. And
oh, well.
So I had the Christian Brothers as well, and they were beastly, you know. And I often think about them now with forgiveness.
Mary mentioned on the Joe Duffy thing, Ho'oponopono.
Yeah, that's it.
Yes.
And it's, I'm sorry. Please forgive me. Thank you.
I love you.
I love you.
I love you. Yeah.
We can do the other stuff. We can do the resentment.
Yeah.
And the baggage and the fucking, the cancerous other stuff.
And it is cancerous. I did it for 40 years because I just couldn't find it in my heart to forgive somebody who had, you know, robbed me of a childhood, essentially, apart from all those lovely little stories and, you know, how good things could be at times. And I spoke to Ray. Ray spoke to me. Ray warned me, like, Ray was in the recovery a little before me. And he said, John, the old resentments are no good. Now, I knew this, and my wife Mary was trying to convince me. And funny, not a day passes now that I don't pray for the Christian Brothers and say, you know, God love them. I don't know what they suffered. I don't know what they went through. I don't know what their institution politically was like inside those big grey walls.
You don't know what beasts were behind them.
Behind them. And all I know, to be honest, Dean, is that I just said, okay, I'm going to hand that over and try and that for that not to be a part of my life. Because I told her that, you know, at parties rather, and mentioned it to everybody all my life. I kind of fueled it. It became a kind of a martyrdom. It became an excuse too for everything I did wrong myself. I wasn't a saint, but I say God loved them and I pray for them. And I mean it sincerely. I get a warm feeling when I do that.
Yeah.
It's absolutely remarkable because that's not John Rooney. That wasn't me, you know.
My dad sat me down this morning. He knew we were coming here.
Right.
And so my dad would be in recovery as well. And he started talking to me about his dad.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, through meetings, through recovery, he went, oh, okay, I see. And I can forgive and I can let it go and I can see it from where he might have been. And that he gave that gift to himself.
That's beautiful. I often think, well, obviously, because I would be, I suppose, close enough to death. I know you guys are hoping it happens on air. Because
it doesn't get much closer than this.
I know about the ratings and the whole lot. But listen till I tell you. I feel when I pass over or walk through that thin veil, what's going to happen is I'm going to go, ah, Jesus, yeah. So that's what it was about. It's that simple. And I believe it is that simple. Our minds can't comprehend it. We're in a different zone. But I believe when I go to another life, and I believe I am going into another life or dimension or whatever, that the answer to all the big existential questions I'd be scratching my head over all my life will be answered as if, do you know, if it, talk about being in recovery. You know, when I was a kid, if I had a joint, right? And I'd get this clarity. Oh my God, that's such, you know, I feel that now just through, you know, a little bit of meditation or prayer or whatever, that when I pass over, the answer to my big why will be so simple. Don't worry, Ray, I'll be leaving you a message. You can look forward to that.
So my friend John passed away 10 years ago, and I was thinking about him a lot over the last couple of weeks. I was thinking about a lot of him in Alice Springs for some reason. He was kind of close to me heart, like, you know. But when I went to see David Gray the other night, John would have been at those gigs with me, and he would have sang all them songs. So it evoked memories, you know. But when he was going, when he knew he was dying, you know, he said, one of the things is that all the dramas and all the different things that go on in the day, he just didn't want to know any of it. He didn't want to know any of that stuff. That was all gone. And then he said to Karen, who was his wife, I'll send you a sign, right? So when he passed, and that, and he was in the coffin and stuff like that. Karen was lying on the bed and she was listening to his music on an iPod, and it died. You know, the battery ran out on it. And at 6 o'clock the next morning, it turned on and played a song, you know. And 6 months before he passed, right, I was in, there was a friend of ours who was a priest, you know, and he'd done John's Mass, and he was saying he knew that he was going to have to do John's Mass and how difficult that was going to be, you know. And I said to him, I keep hearing these words in my head, and it was, go now and paint the sky, because he was a painter. He was a great painter. So when I gave the oration at his funeral, I said at the end, go now and paint the sky, right? And later on that day, the sky lit up. Remember, Dan? It lit up orange. It was Stevens's day,
yeah,
10 years ago. And my sign that I got was, he was mad into Neil Young, Bob Dylan, Beck, and a couple of other, you know, different singers, you know. And no radio station played them, you know.
No.
And I had an internet radio at the time, and I found this radio station called The Freak, or Freak. And that was one of John's things. John was slagging somebody, he'd say, he's a freak. Mm. So I remember, you know, connecting with it. Before the funeral, John had picked 3 songs, and Karen was saying, there's no more songs getting played. And the Eamon said, look, it's going to be a very quiet funeral if you don't play more songs. So some people offered to sing, friends of ours, and they said, will we sing Silent Night? So when they sang Silent Night, it was beautiful because it was Stevens's day, you know. So this day, anyhow, I was in the house and I was really hurt because John had passed, like, you know. And 5 songs came on the radio, right, on the internet radio, and it was Neil Young, Beck, Bob Dylan, whatever the 5 songs
were. Oh, my God.
And I was standing there going, and I had to go. I had to go, and I leave the radio on in the kitchen for the dogs. So I switched it back to the normal radio, which was RTE1,
yeah,
and it was Silent Night, John.
Oh, I don't believe it. This is a thing, and I don't know if it's part of recovery or if there's a... Do you believe in serendipity or in coincidence anymore, well, Ray? I don't.
No, I don't. Like, it's funny, right, because, you know, there's so many things have happened that I just go... That wasn't by accident, like, you know.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know what it is. I still don't know. You know, when people say, is it God? Is it Jesus? Is it Mary? I don't know. But what I feel is it's all of the above.
Yeah.
And when I was out in Alice Springs, I lived in a house with a guy who was absolutely with love with Allah. Like, you know, he was a Muslim guy. He prayed 5 times a day. But he used to allow Mormons into his house once or twice a week. And they'd have all these big discussions. And me and him would go walking a 6 o'clock in the morning, and we talk about this stuff, you know. And I said the same to him. Like, he was kind of saying to me, was I anti-Muslim? And I was like, no, not at all. Because what I feel is that it's all of that and more, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And it's just something that I can't understand what it is. I don't think anybody can. I think we've tried all the times we've been on the earth to try and understand it. And John said, when Eamon said to John one day, where are you going, John, you know? And he says, where do you think you're going? And he had a son that passed. He said, I'm going to go and join Sean, and the two of us are going to hang out in the universe. And Eamon said to him, who was a Catholic priest, that's exactly what I think, you know? And I thought that was deadly.
It's beautiful.
The veil, because you mentioned it on Joe Duffy as well.
Yeah.
For me, it was nice when I got the veil experience.
Yeah.
And for me, it was like, it's here. We're not going anywhere. It's here. And the veil is just the understanding of that. Do you pull it back? And it's kind of a dimensional thing, as you said.
Absolutely. It's parallel almost.
Yeah, it's right here. It's right now. There's only right here and right now. There isn't another time or another place. It's here. It's, and Sparky kind of said some stuff to me last year. It's like tuning just to a different frequency, a different radio station.
Yeah.
We're on Lyric FM.
Yeah.
And that other place is Spin or 98 FM. They're all happening at once.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's all energy. Energy never dies.
That's right.
And as you say, it's the veil for me is closer. And I actually have, you know, seen and heard things in, you know, semi-consciousness or whatever, not truly in sleep. And I've glimpses and I've little insights, and I recognize myself drifting toward a different part, a different life, you know, a different existence. It's not far. And perhaps it is among us. And just to go back to Ray's thing, what I think, Dean, is like we've 16,000 religions and the only thing they all have in common is theirs is the one true God, etc. And there is just the one God. And I don't mean this in any holy Roman Catholic and apostolic way. I don't mean this in any religious way. We're all we have, guys. It's myself and Dean and Ray today now and my wife out in the kitchen, Mary, doing a bit of baking. That's all there is. And I see God in people, in nature, and it's powerful. And before we started our little podcast, Dean came up and he says, hey, I'm going to give you a little kiss on the forehead, John. And it was God. For me, it was God. And I said, yeah. And I relaxed and I just thought, it's that simple. We are all part of a jigsaw, in my humble opinion. And when you die or pass or go walk through that veil, you know, that piece of the jigsaw is put in and eventually we will all be part of the kingdom. I don't know what it is. And I'm sure God, I'm sure she's like a beautiful woman or a terrific Muslim man or, you know, or not an entity at all.
Or a bosom.
Absolutely. It doesn't, like, I keep saying to people, I've no fear. What could I possibly fear? Like losing a body that has had cancer and was riddled with disease, went through all you could think of, and now my heart is beating or whatever it is at 20, it's operating at 24%. My mouth isn't, obviously.
Your dirty mind is working out.
I'm just saying that, Dean, before Ray says it, you know.
Fill in the but blanks. No, yeah. Is that a euphemism?
It is a mystery, and it's a glorious mystery. And it's not anything for... I know I'm not God, and that is all I know. I know there's a power greater than myself, and I understand it's benevolent, because...
What's benevolent mean?
Just really good.
Yeah, okay.
Inherently decent because, you know, because of Sparky's hug this morning or you giving me a kiss or Mary coming in and sitting on the side of the bed and saying, how do you feel, love, whatever. Well, that's God, you know. It's beautiful. That's how I know God exists.
We were in a garage earlier on and a girl smiled at us. But it was God.
Yeah.
And then a fella walked past us.
Yeah.
And all I see now.
Yeah.
In everything.
Yeah.
And it's not just the good stuff. It's all the other stuff as well.
Absolutely.
I see the grace of it all the time.
That's incredible. That grace, that's a gift. That's incredible. Mm. I often say to people, like, nothing good can ever die anyway. And if Sparky walked in, when he came to visit me the last time, like I was in tears when he left. That was understandable. But if I smile at somebody, you know, oh Jesus, sorry, I didn't actually mean that smile. If you just kind of get that back, if you had, nothing good ever dies, and it just builds up the kingdom. I know this man is a good reader. I can't remember the book, or maybe it's the big book. Book, Ray, and your favourite passage thing was about the kingdom. Do you remember that?
Oh, the keys to the kingdom was in the back of the big book.
And
yeah.
You often spoke about it. Sorry, guys, I probably took yours off on a tangent.
There's only one tangent, John, and it's this one.
Fair play.
The keys of the kingdom is in the back. So in the big book, you have 165 pages of how do we do this?
How
does this thing work? How do you do it? How do you stay sober for one day? At a time, because, you know, we try to recover. You know, we try to recover from this thing, and I think we are recovered. But just today, there was people out in Alice Springs and out in Ohio who couldn't get to meetings. So they put stories in, which were like a share, like, you know what I mean? Because when we go to meetings, we share, you know. So the first person will share. And then we kind of respond to that. We talk about what's going on and whatever it is. And one of them is called The Keys of the Kingdom. And basically it says, I replaced drunkenness and hangovers and no connection with my friends and family. And I went into recovery and I gained the keys to the kingdom. You know?
That's basically the gist of it,
you know?
I remember asking you on several different meetings to
read it.
To do that talk for
I remember that. And I actually picked up a book.
Yeah.
I had lost my own book in the house and I found it the other day and I picked it up. And when I opened it, it was on that.
How did you come to meditate?
With immense difficulty, because I don't know if you pick it up on the podcast or my pattern of speech or whatever, but I have a racing mind, you know, that is never at peace. And I'm in a program to help me recover, and it's a spiritual program. And it's recommended that one would meditate, obviously. I mean, sure, it's great to ease the mind and whatever, but I found that end of it very difficult, Dean. And I was standing looking out the window in the little porch there, and Mary has all these bird feeder things. Jeez, the birds are great here. They're fabulous to watch. And I was just, every day I'd stand and stare out at them. And Mary said, John, you know, you worry about meditating. She said, you're very present in every moment. And you've great cop on, for want of a better word. You see things as they are. And you live each moment as it is. And I realized I tended to do that. And she said, look, staring at the birds, that's the most fabulous form of meditation. So when I started to take myself a little less seriously, I had this notion, Dean, I'd have to cross my legs and be humming and the whole
levitate.
Thing.
Levitate.
Exactly. And I said, ah, good luck, lads. I'm not, you know. But no, just being... If I'm washing the dishes, honest to God, and it's very seldom now, I don't have that kind of energy, but I do it mindfully. I say, thank you, whoever you are, for giving me the strength to do this. This is fantastic, and it's a bit of a help for Mary, and it's occupying me. And Dean, I'll be honest, El Son, that's as far as my meditation goes, you know. I've still never sat in silence on my own, just simply being. So I would be, I'd score, 2 out of 10 for meditation. I'd be poor on that.
Yeah, but I remember I had the same issue, you know, because I was trying to meditate. And then I said to this guy who meditates, he said, have you tried it? And I says, well, I come home from work and I sit on the couch. And I just sit there in silence for about an hour. And he goes, that's meditating.
Yeah, there's no one keeping score.
No one keeping
score. And what I do is, I look out the window. There's a tree in my front garden and I just watch it blowing in the wind. And even like looking at those trees there, that's what I would do. I'd sit looking at them and just, it kind of brings me to just to quiet the mind, you know. And I think it's the best part of the day for me, you know. It really, because I have the same mind as you, John. Mind races and.
Yeah.
It's constantly fixing things and thinking about things and that kind of stuff.
So. A lot of lovely people with our disease tend to be like that.
Yeah.
And also, it was no good, Dean, you know, me meditating. I'd have to be the best meditator. Like a medal would have to come from...
You were bleeding competitive with it.
Yeah. Like Uchtdrawn the Heron would have to drop off a medal saying...
So there was no one measuring it, only yourself, John.
Exactly. Yeah. I was, you know, battling myself and very much so. No, it's just simple. It's part of my everyday life. I have a tiny, tiny little statuette of the Holy Family. There's a Mary, a Joseph, and a baby Jesus. And that's lovely for me because it represents everything or anything, you know. Or, you know, it's everything. And I have a little candle beside it. And I keep it lit, and if I'm up at night, because I don't sleep great, I'd have it lit too. And I never pass it without saying a little prayer. And for my prayers, I never feel this beautiful, enveloping, you know, arms of a God around me and this, this feeling of, you know, you're spot on, John. You're, no, I'm just in Egypt standing in my pyjamas saying a prayer, and I don't feel, but I know I don't need to feel that anymore. I don't need, like, one of the guys in my program, like, he got his spirituality and he got his purpose in life, and everything changed from when he went in after a big long drunk and 2 weeks in this mental institution, and he sits up on the bed and the sun bursts through the window and his room lights up and God talks to him and says, you know, none of that happens to me, Dean, you know. Actually, I'd be unlucky in what I'm, there's an old saying, God, there's so many daft things in my life. My mother told me, she said, do you know, John, if there was a shite in the desert, you'd step in it. You know, I was always kind of a little unlucky. And that, I'm happy now.
That, clumsy hole.
Yeah, and I'm happy now, that's who I am. Everything about me, I'm happy who I am.
Yeah.
And when I had the time to be quiet in Alice Springs, I just leaned into myself, you know, and I was just happy enough. And I kind of found, and I was saying this to my parents yesterday, you know, what I learned out there was in the quiet was I'm all right. You know, I'm okay. Yeah. I don't have to be in Ballymun. I don't have to be in Dublin. I don't have to be in Alice Springs. I can be anywhere and be okay. And I remember standing on a platform in Sydney with a mate of mine. He was a great mate of mine. And that struck me really, really, you know, heavy, that I can be anywhere. I could be anywhere and just be who I am, you know. And I remember leaving Australia and heading for the plane, you know, and I was on a bus, had a, you know, the way you, we have all these great plans, I'm going to get the train, I'm going to get down here, and this is going to happen, and that's going to happen. None of that happened because there was works on the rail line, and I had to get a bus, you know.
Yes.
And I remember being on that bus, and every nationality got on that bus. There were Sikhs and, you know, Muslims and all kinds, and old Paddy here, like, you know. And I remember trundling down the road in that bus, and I was just saying, isn't this deadly? You know, isn't this just deadly that I'm here? And then, you know, then I was on a plane for 14 hours, and I nearly went, there was a crying child beside me, you know, and you're on that flight. And I just said, but the one thing that I was thinking all the time was, isn't this great? Isn't this savage just being here? Not everybody gets to get on a plane. Not everybody gets to go and see Alice Springs or the Sydney Opera House. And I went up and put my hand on the Sydney Opera House just to know that it was there. Like, you know what I mean? And just to, you know, and it was savage, you know, it was savage. I remember standing looking at the bridge. I don't know what the bridge is called in Sydney Harbour.
And Sydney Harbour Bridge.
Oi, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
I said, I've never, ever thought I would ever stand here, and there I was, you know. And all that happened really, really quickly. So I don't know what's ahead, John. You know, you don't know what's ahead. You know, you're talking about a veil and going into it, you don't know. And that's isn't that powerful, that we don't know what's ahead?
Absolutely. But what you said there about the Sydney and obviously that was something momentous and big in your life. But what you said prior to that about sitting on the bus or sitting on the plane and being able to be with yourself and accept who you are is incredible. That attitude of gratitude, which I got from my wife, by the way, because, you know, I was a moany old fuck.
You can curse as much as you fucking want.
Okay, I'm not saying the curse. But an attitude of gratitude. I lie in bed at night and I think, imagine if I was as sick as I am now and I've no pain, no nothing. Like, I've a palliative care team and I've all the good stuff.
The morphine.
Morphine, the whole aura morph, all these things. Imagine if I had even a bad cold. You know how you're shivery and it's horrid, and I was in a camp in Palestine somewhere or something. And it's not for comparison. It's just, I find it impossible not to be grateful. I find that impossible. Now, it's a pissy old day in Mayo, right out in the west coast of Ireland.
It's still gorgeous.
And it is. And you guys are half a kilometre from the broad Atlantic Ocean, as they say. And just, you're here now in the little living room and the three of us are having a chat. And I don't know why, and I don't know how, and it evolved, but I know it was meant to happen. And I feel about my God situation now that before I was formed in my mother's womb, my God knew my name and called me by name, and there was a plan. And of course, I didn't give a fuck about any plan. I got on with John Rooney living his own life the way he wanted to, you know. But eventually, lads, I ran out of steam and energy. I had to give up. I had to stop and say, look, if there's something else out there, have a go. I gave it a good shot, you know, and I made balls of it. You know what I mean?
I remember seeing you, John, in Manon View, was it?
Oh, yes, yeah. At a gig, was it?
You were playing there. We used to go down. We have friends who live in Cavan. They would have come down. I remember the first time I came to Ackle, I had an old camper van. They were staying on the campsite, but there was nobody on the campsite. You know, they were just pulling in. And then they said to me, and I went down, and it was like this weather. I can't remember. It was Easter time, and there was no toilets. The public toilets weren't even open. And if we wanted to go up for a number two, you had to buy a coffee in the coffee shop. So the code for the price of a coffee was 2.57. So we'd say to each other, I'm just going up for 2.57.
Ah, God, right? Yeah.
And that was the first time I was in Ackle. And then we came down a couple of times, and you were playing. The Liffey Man, was it?
The Liffey Man, that's right, you were playing in
the Milan View, and there was three sisters.
Oh, and they
were mad for republicanism. Yeah. There wasn't a shelf in the pub or a space on the wall that didn't have a picture of Bobby Sands or Gerry Adams or something like that. And I went up, and I was a Sinn Féin councillor at the time, and she said to your woman, he's a Sinn Féin councillor, you know? Yeah. And your woman just gave me a wink, and then I thought she was putting a shamrock on the top of the
on the pint.
True balaclava.
It was IRA.
That was the Minon was a fabulous place, and their mother would have been from Ballycroy, a real staunch Republican. The whole family, and she wore, if you noticed, a huge big Sam Brown belt when she was serving.
And the three pumps outside the petrol pumps were green, white, and orange.
Green, white, and gold. That's right. Yeah.
But you were in the middle of it then, belting out the tunes.
I was, yeah, and I'm a man of great integrity, you know,
self-proclaimed, like.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was singing all the Wolf Tone songs.
That's sweet.
Anything they wanted. I loved American folk and the whole lot, and I said, no, I'll give this well, you know. And the special branch then would, I used to play a lot of different gigs in different places, but the special branch would turn up at every one of my gigs, and you had to finish on time. And the other pubs on Ackle, they'd go on to Dean till like 3 or 4 in the morning, you know.
I've been in a few of them.
Yeah, yeah. And but the Minon, God love them. Like 1 minute past 11:30, and the special branch out of the cars and into the pub and clearing
John,
people out.
John, what year did you have to decommission the guitar?
When this old heart thing, I've very little breath. Oh God, can I tell you a quick story? You can cut it out. There was a man called Polk, and Polk was about 70 years of age. He was a tall man and a poor man and a lovely soul. And he had a big garda coat. And he used to stand at the top of the brae on Ackle Island. You know, you go up a hill and then down a brae, and then there's, you know, Nirvana and pubs and whatever. And he'd stand there stopping the cars, saying, I'd like you to provide me with a sample of your Brett. And people would shit themselves. And, oh, sorry, guard, sorry. And they'd give him a fiver or a tenner or whatever. and he'd, every busy weekend or holiday, he'd be stopping, and at least two from three, or maybe one from every three cars would say, well, I'm not chancing this, that this is probably what the police look like around here, you know, you'd give him a few, and he'd actually say, I'll take a few bob if you want to be on your way.
Like, he was milking it. I love that.
Yeah. And of course they'd be in whatever hotel I was singing in, they'd be there at 2 or 3 in the morning, and Poke would be there in the corner, lowering the pints. And nobody ever gave out to him. Yeah. Nobody ever went up and said, I want my fiver back. Or we said, he's an ackle character, you know.
That's what you get when you come to the island.
Yeah, he's harmless. Like.
So come here, take us back to your mammy's womb.
Wow.
Because you said something happened there that, you know, John was born, John was named, and then you played that role up until a certain point, you know. So I remember a friend of mine said to me, because I, as a kid, I would have had a fear of dying, and I would have ran into my mother, into her bosom, and screamed, I don't want to die. And my friend said to me, he said, you remember before you were born, what was that like?
Yeah.
Did you feel any pain, or was there any emotion, or do you have any memories, or how long were you not here for?
I remember it. I know it sounds daft. It's only because it's so stark how you put it to me there, Dean. I absolutely remember being in my mother's womb, and it was the most incredibly safe, cocooned environment. And I felt warm and loved and pain-free. It was an incredible feeling. It's like what it's going to be on the other side.
Mm.
I don't think we'd be allowed to take our pain and suffering and cancers with us, you know? You know, growing up, I didn't have advantages in the sense that I was a small, chubby, red-headed lad with freckles in a classroom of 32 other dubs, you know, so no problem there then, obviously. I was artistic. I was very different. Very, very different, and found it hard to get on with lads. I became a people pleaser to, you know, not get as many hidings or beatings or whatever they call it, and knew to let everybody hear whatever they wanted and be everything to everybody. And it's not a surprise I became an actor. That's not a surprise. The most comfortable I ever felt outside of my mother's womb would be on the stage in the Project Art Centre, or on the stage anywhere, playing a character, because I could, you know, take on a role. And so I was never, ever, like Ray said, how happy is just being himself now, just sitting and being. I never had that. I never had that. I lived my life, all my life, for other people, so that I'd be called good, or I wouldn't be slagged, or I wouldn't be beaten, or I wouldn't be bullied, or whatever. It sounds kind of pathetic, but it wasn't even all that bad. You assume the role and you do it, you know?
I was watching the Robin Williams documentary last night on Sky Documentaries, and then straight after was George Carlin, and they had had lives, they had had parents, they had had alcoholism, they had had all types of stuff, and they assume the roles, and we all assume the roles. Mm. We all build on that initial burst from our mother's womb, and we play that role, and we find out who we are, and we make the mistakes, and there's ups and downs, and then we get to that place which you're in.
Yeah, but I would be what you would colloquially call a gobshite. Like, I mean, it took
me... Show me someone who isn't.
Yeah, but God, it took me so long, Dean. You know, I fought for... I became such a fabulous chameleon. Nobody knew who or what I was. And it didn't matter if I went into a room of angels or devils. They all loved me after 5 minutes. Are you with me?
You have to thank the mad fucking chameleon fucker.
Yeah.
Because he's brought you to... He's brought you through the bottle to this room now.
To this very place at this very moment, where I am exceedingly happy. I have zero fear. Now, I was afraid of the postman. I was afraid of going into busy supermarkets, or like I'd break out into a cold sweat to have to do anything different, or, you know, and I was a, like, talk about being an actor or a musician, a performer. I'd be shitting myself. I've no fear today. You know, and so, oh, but John, you're like poor old Joe Duffy. Dying, yeah, in the bed, yeah. I have no...
What will you miss there now? When I'm not here right now, I'll be somewhere else
I'll be somewhere else. And so for a person like me, having lived the life I've lived, to have no fear when I was consumed, that's all I had. I was consumed by it. It's a miracle. Now, I don't know what a miracle, you know, again, I don't want this to be a religious thing whatsoever. This is an everything. This is an absolutely everything. You know what I mean? Mm. Like our concept of our God. I am just happy, beyond happy, grateful, absolutely full of joy and without fear. Do you know when you say it out loud to yourself? Like, I think it about, did I just say that out loud? I did.
And it's not for show, and it's not an act.
That's true, yeah. And I'm not trying to impress you, Dean, or you, Ray, and no, that wouldn't be me.
Because I think you died already.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm with you, totally.
If you die before you die, you don't die when you die.
Yeah, I think that skin has been cast off, and somewhere along the way, that old actor passed on, and John Rooney said, "Well, I'm going to live the rest of this life, and walk into the next."
I got a skip in the house a couple of years ago. Right, I'm a terrible hoarder, still am, you know. But I was, and I got the skip, and I got out into the shed. And I said, "I'm going to take advantage of this," and I start emptying the shed from the front, you know. And then but as I was getting in deeper, I was saying to myself, who was I? Who was this person that bought that lamp? And then I went up and I got into the attic, and the same thing, like, you know, I was saying, who was Ray? Who was Sparky, that fella? And even when I went to see David Gray the other night, and I was thinking of the fears I had, what kind of a gobshite was I at 35 years of age, you know? And I thought at 35 years of age, I was some kind of fucking genius, you know. I thought I was some kind of...
Absolutely.
You know, like, I thought, before I came into recovery, I was the soundest person that ever lived. And it was only in the quietness of recovery. Myself and Dan had a live podcast, you know. None of my friends came to the podcast, and none of my family came to the podcast, you know. And I was like, fuck you, like, you know? Yeah. That's what I was thinking, you know. Dean had put huge amount of work into advertising and that. But my sister Jennifer did her 100th park run. She said to me the day before, will you come up, you know? And everything in me was saying, no.
No, I'm not going to your gig. I'm not going to your thing.
Yeah. Your gig,
well, I was doing an important thing last night and you never turned up, you scaldy
bastard. But that didn't happen to me, because... That's that 35-year-old gobshite. Right. I did turn up and I was able to give her a hug and have a cup of tea and head off. That's recovery.
In a nutshell.
I think it says in the second step, it says we'll be restored to sanity. And I was like, I remember coming in, you know, and I was like, I'm not insane, you know. But, and it doesn't say insane. It says restored to sanity. And sanity for me is on a Tuesday night putting the bins out. You know, feeding the dogs on time, bringing them for their walk, and then turning up for the 100 park run. I just want to be without people. When I do turn up, it's joyous. When I do turn up to Mayo to do this, I wasn't looking forward to the journey, but the journey with Dean today was amazing. Yeah. And the stuff, the depths of conversation that we went into, and the depths of our sense of humour is dark.
Yes.
And we were laughing about things, you know. And the joy is in the journey, John. You know, the joy is in the journey, and you know, you were saying, "Oh, well, I'm at the end," but you mightn't be at the end. This might be the beginning. That's what John Duffy says in his thing. You know, this is not the end. This is only the beginning. I had that fear that you were talking about, Dean. I don't want to die. I had a terrible fear of dying.
Yeah,
don't really have it now. You know, we were talking about when we were overtaking a tractor. You know, and you see a car coming over the hill and you go, fuck, right? But isn't there something beautiful in that as well?
Yeah.
You know, in that where you're alive, you know, and you get ahead and you know, the airbags aren't popping off, you know. Life is great. I have peace of mind. And now I don't have it every day. There's days I'm snappy and I'm sure my family, like if you want to know how I'm doing, ask me family. Most of the time I don't know, but when I have peace of mind, it's lovely. You know, it's nice. We had peace of mind coming down the car today.
Yeah.
Peace of mind here today.
Beautiful.
It's lovely. It's a gorgeous thing, you know. It's great having that awareness when I'm not great. You know, like, because Christmas time is a dark time for me, you know. And I don't know why it is. I didn't, you know, when I grew up as a child, like you were talking about, we were filled with presents and all that kind of stuff.
I had
aunts and a granny that bought us presents as well, you know, and we had a great old time. But there is a darkness in me around Christmas time for whatever reason. And I've got great acceptance around it now that when it comes, it comes. And a mate of mine said to me that he hadn't heard from me, you know, and I was talking about the darkness. But here's the thing. I know about it. I know it's there. The black dog, the darkness. Yeah. I know about it. I know it's there. And when I'm in the middle of it, I can go, right. And what I do in that is I light a fire in the house. I listen to music. And I try and do a bit of meditation. And I always say to myself, this too shall pass. This will pass.
And this too will pass.
Yeah.
And it's all grist for the mill. The ups and the downs. The bastard priests. The evil people. The love. The bosom. Yeah. It's all part of it. After you were born in that room in North Circular and you had your man, your dad, and you got the bleeding ice cream and then something else happened. You were probably an altar boy or probably studying to be a priest and all.
I was for a few years, yeah, yeah. Well, I was a late vocation then, but I was 21 years old and they usually went in about 17, you know, it took about 7 years. You got your minor orders first and then your major orders. So I would have been ordained by the Roman Church. I would have been ordained a lector and an acolyte. Basically, all that means is a lector is a reader. So
on the lectern,
exactly. That's it. And I could, if there wasn't a priest present or whatever, I could preach on the gospel, and then been an acolyte, I could take communion to the sick, or I could. But of course, they say all that, but they never ever let you do it until you're fully ordained, because you know it dilutes their power.
You might embarrass them.
Yeah, yeah. Or you might, yeah, you could make a balls of it. You know
it might come out that you were a bit, you know.
So, yeah.
So but, you're like an acolyte now, because acolyte's only down the road.
Acolyte's around the corner. I'm married to one woman from the island. They are very much, genuinely, guys, they're a different breed. They are a completely different people. You even see it in the older photographs. The strength and resilience, like, because they lived through the worst times of the genocide, of the famine and all that kind of thing. They had nothing, only themselves, and they had to persevere. So there's a hardness about them. But you know the way, Dean, you think, well, they're so used to tourists and they're happy clappy and, you know, all this kind of stuff. They are and they aren't. They are after a fashion, but they have a hardness, and you have to kind of scrape away a little bit of a layer, and when they get to know you, that's fine, you know. But first and foremost, they look out for themselves and their own. Isn't that amazing to think in the 21st century? It's just, even on a tiny island like Ireland, there is a difference between Dubs and Islanders and Northerners, you know, and people from the Golden Vale. I know we're all similar, but it's beautiful to see that, you know, that mix. It really is gorgeous. Like, I know I was a mixed up kid, but I wasn't religious, But I loved the idea of helping people. And I really hope that doesn't come across as ego. In my heart, I had a burning desire to help people. If I could do it, and I thought maybe the road of the priesthood would be the way to do it, even from a young age. Now, I played hurling and football for St. Vincent's. They were a Dublin team. They were down, in the old days, they were right down in Raheny, right? And in my bag, in my hurling bag, my kit bag, I would walk those couple of miles through Eden Moor, and I'd have my tap shoes for Billy Barry's School of Dancing.
Lovely, yeah.
You know the way people ask you, Dean, right, if you could have three or four people around and you're having dinner, who are you going to have? You know, Nelson Mandela, Elizabeth Taylor, you know, this kind of thing. I'd have Jesus. My hero was Jesus. Mm. I just thought, like, this guy, this dark-skinned guy with hair down to his shoulders, walking around in sandals, daring to upset the establishment, you know? I could feel that. If I had a dinner party now and I could have anybody at it, I'd have Jesus at it and have the crack. Jesus, I might be seeing him soon enough. But
tell him we were asking for him.
So your childhood was mainly Coolock?
Absolutely, yeah. I moved out to Coolock, I'm guessing 3.5, you know what I mean? When we left Granny's house, I'd say 3.5, yeah. There was such a buzz. I remember the first man on our road to get her car was Tom Ellis. Tom worked for the ESB and he had a bubble car. It had three wheels. It had two wheels at the front and one wheel at the back. And to get into the car, there was a bubble on the front and the whole front of the car opened out.
A Henkel. It's a German car.
A German car.
So my dad had a Fiat 500.
Yeah.
And somebody gave it to him and it was tiny. And I learned to drive it, actually. He said it was great because he used to go up the side of the traffic. It was so small, you know.
Well, 14 or 15, I remember my dad had a Honda 50 at that stage. And driving through Coolock Village, I'd always be on the front of the bike anyway, you know what I mean? And he was stopped by a policeman, took his name and address and whatever, and made him walk the bike all the way home with me. And the overpowering feeling I had was, but my dad is so powerful.
My dad's a superhero.
My dad, and he has to walk home with the bike. And I got a deep, abiding hatred for that policeman. Unbelievable. That was the first bang, the first real flash of it. Now that I remember, Dean, there were loads of things, of course, you know. I remember, never forget that as long as I live.
You know, I seen my dad getting a punch off another man.
Oh, God.
Then I seen him getting, he was carrying Christmas presents like a tennis racket in his hand.
Yes.
And a van came past and knocked it. And he was vulnerable in that moment. So seeing me dad being vulnerable was one of those poignant moments.
It really affects you, doesn't it?
It's great. In hindsight, it's great.
Yeah, because I know now my dad was just, Tom Rooney was an ordinary man, a lovely man. But when, for the first time in your life, you realise your dad isn't like God Almighty, the superhero, like you said, Dean. That was a killer. Yeah.
What was he working at? Or what was your man doing?
A printer all his life.
Right.
And my mother worked. She'd never let you say in the bookies. She said, no, I work in a turf accountants.
Oh, yeah, I remember the name over the door.
Do you? So there was a place in Artane there called PJ Kilmartin's. They were the bookies. And she used to work for the bookies. And my dad was a printer. He was 7 years serving his time as a linotype operator. So he'd be typing and the hot metal would go into the little tube and it would form an A, B, C, whatever. But you really had to hammer the keys. And my dad, you know, we all have an old laptop or whatever we have today. But my dad could type so fast. I was so proud of him because in those days on a Saturday, if he was doing overtime, I was allowed to go into work and the bell would ring and they had exactly 15 minutes break and the women would go around and take the order and they'd say, what would you like, son? And I'd say, I don't know. I was, you know, afraid. And my dad would say, you can have anything you like. Would you like a Cadbury snack? I said, yeah. And they all had like tin mugs. They all had their own mug. The linotype department, you know, the typesetters.
Where was this, John? Letter.
In Belvedere Place, John F. Newman and Son, bookbinders and printers. Yeah.
I'd say the smells were...
Look, and we were talking
the
about...
paper, the ink, the glues.
Yeah, and upstairs at the bookbinding, the leather.
Yeah.
And the whole lot. And there was a great smell off paper, Dean. It was gorgeous because they had big guillotines, programmatic guillotines even then. And they go, the smell would come from
the
that.
Smell of the stock paper. Yeah,
absolutely. And so that's what Mam and Dad did. That's what they were doing. And then we got our first car and my father made a mistake. He announced it first. He said, wait, I tell you guys, I have something to tell you. We're getting a car. And we'd only just got a television. Now, we weren't poor or anything like that. Like printing was great. I'm just saying nobody had Mr. Ellis had a bubble car. And we were so excited. I was dreaming about a Zephyr or, a brand new. And because I used to love seeing those on Z cars on the telly. And we heard this yoke clunking down the fucking road. a Morris Minor, a second, third, fourth hand Morris Minor, KZD99. I'll never forget it. That was the reg. He said, come on, we'll get in the car. And I was saying, you're having a laugh. I'm not, people will see us. I would have preferred the bubble car, but in my teenage child mind, I thought that my dad is getting a new car. We're going to have our first car. I didn't realise he'd come home with an old rust bucket of a Morris Minor. That is what he could afford at the time. Yeah. And that man was so proud. And I wasn't. And I was downing it and whatever. And I often think back to times like that when we inadvertently hurt our parents, even though they're the adult in the relationship.
Yeah.
I'd say I hurt my dad.
So I was making my communion, or confirmation, I think it was, and my dad had Ford Cortina, and it was a good car. It was a good car.
Yeah.
But something happened. It was probably broke or something like that, and he got a loan of a Volkswagen Estate. It wasn't a Beetle. It was like a variant. Remember the Volkswagen variant? And it was left-hand, right? Now, imagine how cool that is now, right? And I was like, get that. I was disgusted, like you.
01-842-3692.
That was your first phone number?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Give us it again.
01-842-3692.
Yeah, 847-6829. That was my Mazda.
And you always called the number out. So if your best friend or your mother or whoever was ringing you, it was, hello, 985-364. And say, it wasn't, hiya, this is Betty. You know what I mean? Hello, you're calling 985-364. Who would you like to speak to?
Ma!
It's me, Isn't that amazing?
I'm thinking in my head, yous are out in the sticks. Coolock is out in the sticks.
Yeah.
Yous are townies moving out to the sticks.
And Coolock Village is still a village. I go down there every Saturday, and it's still Coyles and... Do you remember KP Stenson's?
I do. Stenson's and Kyle's and the Sheaf of Wheat. I was a lounge boy in the Sheaf of Wheat.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous now. Something like the Dog's Bollocks now it's called. It is. No, it is. It is something like that, The Cock and Bull. It's called the Cock and Bull.
I go into the old church. There used to be a disco in there.
St. Brendan's old church. Deaconess Church, and they'd have the disco.
But I think you knew my cousin, David Corcoran.
Yeah.
I was saying that to you before.
Yeah, I remember when you came to visit me.
Yeah, David said he knew you.
Yeah.
He said a red-headed rawhead with a guitar,
Yeah. Across the road from my house was an old derelict Protestant church. Behind that is a big, an omniplex now, I think it is, Dean. It has all, and Chadwick's or something. I worked there in a place called Kelly Print. I was a salesman. I would have been about 19 years or something, or 18 years of age. But like, that was a great gig for somebody so young, because there was a Best's men's shop in O'Connell Street, and I had a clothes account in there, and I had a car at that age, like awful precocious in a way, but I wasn't a precocious young fella. But I remember I shared a secretary with somebody in the next office in Kellyprint. Larry was the name, lovely fella, Larry. And our secretary was Paula Lewis. And sure, she was only a year younger than me, but she was absolutely gorgeous. And she was so vivacious and full of life. And I'd get the phone and say, I'd say, Larry, is Paula with you? And she'd come in. We were nearly jealous, like sharing this terrific young woman. Oh, she was got a great head on her shoulders. And I remember her saying, we were wrapping up and saying, you doing anything nice for the weekend, Paula? She said, no, I'm going to Stardust. And I said, oh, very good. Because I'd been lots of times, but I'd been to see the Wolf Tones and things like that. You know, I wouldn't. And there was no Paula, of course, on Monday morning. And we heard that she, you know, had that horrific death with those other young people in the locked up Stardust. You know, when your first cat dies, your first dog dies, then a human being belonging to you dies. You know, this was the first time it really hit me that death, and death like that, was so final. Because there were so many Mondays I sat in that office, and me and Larry, there was no Paula, you know, and she was the life and soul of everything. And she was trying to describe the dress she, and I had no more interest, you know, and she was, and I realized, it made me realize that you really should make an effort not to miss a single moment, because there were little chats I had with Paula, and I wasn't really listening. I was being polite, you know, so I could get on, but like, what Paula had to say wasn't really that important. Like, that's shameful. Do you know what I mean? It's a thing that fills me with shame. There are other things we had to get over, Ray, stuff like that. But my brother, Greg, is married to Joan Pearson from Edenmore. Joan barely escaped. You wonder how it affects people's lives to this day. And what age is Joan now? I'm 64. Joan would be about 62. To this day, they can't go on holidays. They can't stay in a hotel unless she's on the ground floor in the first room. She cannot go into a lift. It's so difficult for them to have a holiday anywhere because they have to be on the ground floor with this room. She will only sit with her back to the wall. She can never sit, you know, among people. And she's a sane, beautiful, highly intelligent woman with no addiction issues, no mental issues, but her life is completely scarred to this day.
Mm. My ma and dad were in there that night, you know, and my dad got everybody in the company that they were in out, but he went back in to help people, and I think to this day he's still affected by it, you know. You know, it was great when I walked in the door today and you were standing there. It was one of the best. It was one of the finest moments see you standing there, because I was expecting you to be still bedridden and you're not, which is great.
Thank you for the welcome.
Oh, goodness, Dean. It's the least I can do. Driving across the country and back on a day like this. And as the man says, I put a shirt on and got out of bed with a real pep in my step. And I have to tell you now, I'm sitting here, bollocks now. It's actually like I was out doing a marathon. So it does, you know, the heart, when it slows down, the whole lot slows down. But it was such a pleasure to see you lads. And Ray, you know, my old mate Sparky, like, we were besties from day one. And you would imagine that was a lifetime ago. But like Dean mentioned earlier on, it was a different lifetime ago. We're different men. Yeah, we've known each other since we were the real men we were meant to be.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
You're my older brother in recovery. That's what I always call you.
Yeah, that's it.
We're always in touch.
That's
right. The old WhatsApp text is great. The voice message.
Ah, they're great. They're great. Yeah, but you helped me. You helped me on the road. The reason I've no fear today, and I'm a man full of joy and gratitude, is because of people like you, Ray. And that doesn't make you special. That's the thing about this program. We all do this for each other.
Yeah, yeah, it's great.
You know, people coming in first, Dean, they can't cop this. Hold on, what's this going to cost? What is your man looking for? This fella's so friendly, he's gay. There's something.
What's the game? What's the scam?
Yeah, it's a great, glorious fellowship, and it's a wonderful life, lads.
Will you give us an old tune?
We actually mentioned Ewan McCall, his son, been at your gig, Ray. I personally think we're all travelling people, and this is our journey, you know? And Ewan McCall wrote
What's
this.
The
Freeborn Man of the Travelling People. I'm a freeborn man. You have it straight away, Ray. Is it okay to tell the listeners that literally I don't have a lot of breath, so I'll just give it a go? Because I love to sing anyway. It doesn't have to be perfect. What the hell? I'm a freeborn man of the travelling people. Got no fixed abode, with nomads I am numbered. Country lanes and byways were always my ways. I never fancied being lumbered. In the open ground we could stop and linger for a month or two, for time was not our master. Then we'd pack our load and be on the road. Nice and easy, don't go faster. And just to tell your listeners, guys, I'm out of breath and I'm going to skip to the last verse. I really do appreciate it, because this will be my last song. All you freeborn men of the travelling people, every tinker, rolling stone and gypsy rover, winds of change are blowing, old ways are going. My travelling days will soon be over.
Thank you, John.
Sorry, it got me at the end. You know, when it's kind of like...
Give us a kiss.
You're a gas man, Dean. You're a gas man.
Love you. Love you, brother.
Love you too, pal. Love you too, Ray. Thanks, Sparky.
No, thank you for that. That was amazing.
Here. Fuck off, will you? Fresh, yeah?
Yeah, that'll be my last song. Isn't that crazy? Crazy thing to think, like, you know. Shut the fuck up!
John Rooney. John, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you? I was actually telling a researcher I'm in top form. I'll be honest, Joe, I'm very, very lucky, very blessed man, and very grateful, because if you think about it, I'm in a hospital bed they supplied in my own little room.
Yeah.
I have my TV, I have my gorgeous wife, Mary.
Yeah.
I'm able to die at home. My pain and what I would suffer during the night is just chest pain. Joe, could you imagine what people have to go through? You know, some people have to suffer so much. Could you imagine being in a camp in Palestine and being unwell? Reflected back over my life one day, and I took out a pen and paper and I wrote a gratitude list. And Joe, there's no way I could be, like, I've had a great life, and I realize now all my blessings. You know, I don't regret anything in the past, but it's only now I realise, gosh, I am so lucky and I'm delighted to have every day. And
you're only 64.
I suppose it's all relative. Yeah, Joe, I started with heart problems. I had a quadruple bypass at aged 40. And subsequently, nine stents fitted. So they've done all they can. And they're just wonderful. They're wonderful people, Joe. And you realise things like neighbours call in for a chat.
Yeah.
And I reminisce and I sit here sometimes at night. Now, the only frightening part is the nights when the pain is bad, you know, I would think, okay, is this it? Is this it this time?
Okay.
That's the only thing. And once that, what I do, Joe, is I get up, I make a nice cup of tea. I will knock on Netflix. I was saying to your researcher, I wouldn't tend now to face into something like a rerun of The Sopranos. I stick to miniseries. It's safer.
I get you now.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're very stoic.
Joe, people are good to you. Our people are just great. If you knew the nurses that cared for me and the care I get off my wife, and my daughter came home from a place called Housen in the Netherlands to be here and care for me. It's just, I don't know, I think life is great, Joe. I really do. I pray for people in a worse situation. Mm. And I have a heart just full of gratitude. It's hard to explain. Okay, a lot of levity and a lot of joy in this house, Joe. And I actually got embarrassed that I was still alive at Christmas because a year had passed. And, you know, when lovely people come in and visit and say, oh, God, sorry, John, about that. And you'd get a knock on the door and say, oh, geez, Mary, tell them I'm gone, love. When you're in this situation, you just seem to see the goodness in people. Oh, it's startling. I mean, that's where I don't know who he or she is. I don't know who God is, but it's just so benevolent and beautiful. And I see it in people.
Yeah.
People are amazing, Joe. And you know the way the world is now. Mm-hmm. And like it's in a terrible state. Yeah. Chassis. Who said that? Sean O'Casey, I think.
And where do you think you'll go when you eventually pass, which we all will?
Joe, I think we pass through a very thin veil into another dimension where there is something massive and benevolent and loving. I think when I die, Joe, my first thing when I die will be, oh God, yeah, is that what it was all about? You know, the answer to all these big existential questions will be, oh my God, it's that simple. And how are you, God? And he'd probably say, oh, look, sorry for all the shit I put you through. but come in, you're welcome. Well, I am open for that, Joe. I just realise I'm blessed. I'm blessed by other people's and a beautiful outside force. I just see love in people. And sometimes at night I'd have a few tears. And that's a typical man, Joe, because I don't mind dying, but like, is it going to hurt? You know what I mean?
Mm.
Kind of a man's reaction. I like have gorgeous children and grandchildren, and I'm blessed with a beautiful, beautiful woman for a wife. And oh God, if you can have an attitude of gratitude and somehow accept where you are, and everything I've done in my life has led up to this point, Joe. You know, it's for everything there is a season. You know, Joe, it's not to say that there are nights I'd sit here and say, oh, that pain is horrid and I'll take some morphine and I hope it goes away. And sometimes I sit on the side of the bed and I say, look, it could be tonight. And, you know, that it can be a little disconcerting, but not fear, Joe. There's no great fear there. And that's genuine. What I'll miss most, and it's that because I'll be in another realm or I'll be in heaven, whatever. What I'll miss most is Mary, like my wife. We're 40 years married, Joe. She encapsulates, she is the essence of love. really. And for everybody out there in any kind of pain or discomfort or worry or fear, Mary and I will pray for you and enjoy. Oh, what a beautiful morning from Oklahoma. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, John. You're a legend.
I've got a beautiful feeling, everything's going my way. Oh, what a beautiful day.
Ray and Dean, thank you guys for travelling all the way across the country and back for our chat today and the podcast. It really gave me a huge lift. You're two wonderful, wonderful gentlemen. And I was delighted. I had lots of breath for the podcast, and they only lost it at the end when I realised that the singing voice was gone, and that would be my last song ever. So, sorry for tearing up at the end of it. Thanks for that terrific lift in spirits for me, and I deeply appreciate it. And I'll always remember it.